for us at every moment in time, and certainly this one, to see the moment in time in which we exist and are present, and to be able to contextualize it, to understand where we exist in the history and in the moment as it relates not only to the past, but the future.
You know, I'm starting to think this new philosophy coming out of the US is, well, crap. But you can usually find something in the philosophy that makes sense and improves your life. One last chance.
Without semiconductors, your smartphone would not be a smartphone. It would be a paperweight that occupies a big space in your pocket.
Yeah, I think I'm ready to toss this shit out, but we've got to remember, I guess, that Carla is only the number two guru. Perhaps we should hear from the head guy.
By the way, the same stable genius who said the biggest problem we had in the Revolutionary War is we didn't have enough airports. Whoa. Yo, man, I tell you what. Look.
I think I get it now. These two are just permanently stained on bloody mushrooms. That's the problem. What they're saying sounds great in their own ears, but perhaps not to other people. As for the comment from Sleepy Joe there about the Americans needed more airports during the Revolutionary War, well, we'll be up to the Revolutionary War pretty soon, and we'll be able to check out for ourselves whether we think the Americans needed more airports. I'm guessing not, but then Sleepy Joe thinks he's going to build a railroad across the Indian Ocean. Yeah, I think he's lost it. Oh well, don't we all look forward to the return of King Donald? Welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, Episode 311, A New Queen. Yeah, that'll be great, won't it? My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it. Last week we were having a fiddle around with Bach with his Toccata and Fugue in D minor with all the fast and flashy stuff. So in 1725, Vivaldi said, hang on a tick, check this shit out. So you can't say it's not fast and furious, my dear listener. That was, of course, Winter from the Four Seasons. Brilliant stuff. But we're supposed to be talking about Carolyn. We were doing her backstory and things weren't going that well, were they, between the prince and the princess with dear old German George. I don't know why I said dear old German George, because he's a bit of a turd, really, isn't he? So we got up to the stage where, really, well, it's time for the Jacobite uprising. Great. Something for Prince George to take care of, except, of course, German George says no. Duke of Argyle can take care of that, young George. Now, Argyle will go and have that Sheriff Muir thing, and he'll be talking it up as a mighty victory, with his forces being totally outnumbered, but he pulled a victory out of his arse. And nobody believes him, but it fed Prince George's sulkiness. Worse, yeah, German George will sack Argyle, smart move there, and replace him with, well, not Prince George, but William Cadogan. German George, as we have seen, had no sympathy for the captured Jacobite peers. Carolyn then can take that traditional queenly role and do a bit of begging for mercy. Carolyn did not beg for our man Lord Maxwell, but did beg for Robert Dalzell, 5th Earl of Carnwath. She did some nice boo-hoo-hooing for German George, nice and publicly. Robert then was the guy who just stayed in the slammer on death row until German George issued his general pardon a couple of years later, and it was off you go, laddie. Carolyn will do more of the begging for mercy with German George and Prince George once Prince George becomes King George. Apart from crying over condemned traitors, Carolyn is learning English folk dancing and winning over the wives of whoever turns up and being generally charming. The popularity of the young royal couple is going through the roof. She's also getting into English history, and well done there. Well done. You need to know this stuff if you're going to be a royal. The history is about parliaments, as it turns out. Yeah, there you go. All this being an Anglophile, though, looks to German George as a challenge to him as the rightful monarch. It's not fuckwit. It's about setting herself up for the future. She's flattering English people. German George isn't. You could do that, German George. Oh, now she's gone a bit too crazy. Oh, she's got biographies on all five of them. Can you remember the five, my dear listener? Let's do it. Henry VII, Henry VIII, Teen Kitty, Ted, Mary the Bloody, and finally the Gloriana. And that's not enough. She's collected portraits of all them. Next we'll see a play dedicated to Caroline, The Tragedy of Lady Jane Grey, a Protestant martyr. Yeah, that links in with Caroline, doesn't it? The noblest subject, a heroine, a martyr, and a queen. Yeah, putting it on a bit there. No wandering glance, one wanton thought confessed. No guilty wish inflamed her spotless breast. The only love that warmed her blooming youth was husband, England, liberty, and truth. Oh, lovely bit of propaganda there. Crappy poetry, but lovely propaganda. And propaganda might be needed in Scotland, where German George is called a turnip hoer, and young George is called Konigsmark's bastard. No problem in Wales, though, with the Welsh starting a charitable foundation with young George as its president. It is called the Most Honourable and Loyal Society of Ancient Britons. Yes, that's a nice contrast to the scotty, filthy, traitorous Jacobites. The Welsh committee are looking for Caroline to give it a tick of approval, which she will, and she will then graciously allow each of them to kiss her hand. And Caroline will get excellent press coverage for that, and further reward the Welsh by taking two young, hot Welsh chicks in as maids of honour. Great stuff. They'll still be in Wales on St. David's Day, so here are the Prince and Princess of Wales wearing their leeks on their whatever, showing that they are truly Welsh. Winter, yeah, Vivaldi's just written that, hasn't it? Winter and the Thames will freeze for 2 months. There's no making money for boatmen if the bloody thing's frozen over, so Caroline will donate cash for their relief. Oh, God, can she win over any more people? Of course. It will be a collection of the best Scotch songs as a little project. And Caroline is extending support for the Germans to Wales and Scotland. Yeah, they're starting to like the Germans because of Caroline. German George can go for his first holiday to Hanover. Prince George is named Guardian and Lieutenant of the Realm. That's not a regent, so his powers are limited. It's a bit of an insult if you're a prince. Worse is that young George was told to sack Argyle from his household. He's a bad influence, so young George has got to sack his mate. Young George will say he's resolved to sacrifice everything to please and live well with the king. That's princely code for saying, I'm getting a bit fucking pissed off with this stuff. Caroline will certainly show everyone that she is with a man on the being pissed off stuff. The writings say the Argyle's dismissal left her all in a flame. They will not be joining German George at Kensington Palace where rooms have been prepared for them. No, we're going to have a salt, thank you. Still, as a show of family unity, German George will attend the Caroline's drawing room the night before he goes, and Prince George will go with German George so far as the royal yacht. Soon as German George is gone, the couple are off to Sir Godfrey Kneller for a portrait. In this, Caroline's wearing ermine. Oh, and there's a silly hat right next to her elbow. Oh, and what's that behind her? Oh, does that look like the big chair? Our power couple seem to be sending a message. We're ready to take over. And with that portrait done, they're off to Hampton Court for the fun and to wow people. And it's not just the big dicks they're looking to impress. They organise running races for the local snotty kiddies with prizes provided by the royal purse. They open the gates to the garden to allow common smellies to wander around. Our princess will even talk to a common smelly girlie in a straw hat. That is, the common smelly girlie's got a straw hat, not Caroline. And we're all talking about how marvellous that was. And the courtiers will start buying straw hats. Of course they will. Suckers uppers. Jim and George's spies are not reporting on running races for snotty children, but Tories turning up. Tories, another subversive like Argyle. Annoyer-in-chief of the royal couple will be Turnip Townsend, the sneeringest, fawningest knave that ever was, according to Carolyn. Stupid Turnip, misreading the situation, will show contempt to Carolyn, the girlie, and see how he goes with Henrietta Howard, the maybe mistress. Turnip supporters will take him aside and say, "Look, mate, you bloody idiot, you've missed the real power, it's Carolyn." And so the sucking up to Carolyn will commence. Carolyn, having been given the respect, will now be okay with Turnip. Carolyn, though, will let Prince George off the leash. He's off to visit some big swinging dicks in their own mansions, while a very pregnant Carolyn can put her feet up. Old German George will not be pleased with the prince's actions, going to visit power players. Let's get Carolyn into labour. 5 days of it. Oh, jeez, 5 bloody days of labour. Lady listeners, are your eyes watering? Lots of squabbling over the arrangements. George and Carolyn wanted a German midwife. The English want an English doctor. After some argy-bargy, we say yes to both. The English doctor does not speak German. The German midwife does not speak English. Carolyn's in trouble, but that doesn't stop the argy-bargy going on. Then the midwife will just stop work because she'd been threatened with a good hanging if Carolyn died. Meanwhile, poor old bloody Carolyn is suffering. Finally, out comes a dead baby boy, some sort of wound to its head. A year later, and out comes a healthy, bouncing baby boy. Everything had gone splendidly well this time. There were plenty of witnesses, and there were German and English doctors working cooperatively together. Ring the bells, light the bonfires, get the fireworks going. It's all happiness for a minute or two. German George will insist the kitty be named George William. No, say Carolyn and young George. We don't like that. It's too German. We'll have William George. That's nicely English, William. But German George says no. It's got to be George William. German George also canned the prince and princess's choice of godparents and sent in the Duke of Newcastle, who we hate. Carolyn was totally pissed off. She'd chosen two family members who had plenty of cash, and that could be helpful to her second son. We'll have that mix-up then, where Newcastle thinks Prince George has challenged him to a duel, and everything's gone pear-shaped. German George really played this one very badly. He should have had the prince straight in on the carpet for a please explain, and then he might have got the real story. But he just accepted what Newcastle said. On top of this, we've got teams forming. Stanhope and Sunderland versus Walpole and Turnip. Prince George will go with Team Walpole and Turnip and tell his guys in Parliament to vote against Stanhope and Sunderland. Plus, the Prince will now stop attending Cabinet meetings. Now, I think this has been covered enough. German George starts his charm offensive. Yada blah. The Prince and Princess are kicked out. Yada blah. Off to Leicester House. And Carolyn's now 35 and hasn't seen her eldest lad, Fred, for 4 years. Baby George William will die and there's much boo-hoo-hooing. Lots of sympathy for Carolyn, and we all think German George is an arsehole for having separated the kiddies from their parents. We get the even bigger split where women have to stop attending the prince and princess because their husbands are attending the king. And if you visit the prince and princess, you aren't welcome to visit the king. All very petty, but pretty bloody tough. There are plenty of letters on record showing that Carolyn wrote to her closest friends, working out secret rendezvous with them. Lots of them managed to make it. She also decided to keep on with the happy court idea and invited lots of England's best and brightest. She got to hang on to her maids of honour, who provided a big draw card for the young gentleman. The other big draw card was our Henrietta Howard, who, it was said, could warm an old monk in his cell. Or this one about Mary LaPelle, maid of honour. Should Venus now rise from the ocean and make it appear in a shell, she would not cause half the emotion that we feel for dear Molly LaPelle. Brilliant stuff, that one. But it was Mary Bellenden who got young George hard. George failed to get it, though. He was totally up front, letting Mary know, "It's just lust. All I want is a darn good rogering, Mary, nothing else, so don't expect love poetry from me. Just that darn good rogering and we'll all be good." He thought it'd be easy peasy because poor Mary was broke, so George would count coins in front of her. But Mary was not digging George at all, no. Henry had a howler, though, will certainly go along with George, but Henrietta's going to end up as a proper mistress. Yeah, young Mary Bellenden might have, who knows, but George just isn't much of communication. The eldest daughter, Anne, wrote frequently to her mum and dad, and it's all very sad, my dear listener. We have a good father and a good mother, and yet we are like charity children. Yeah, that's what she's saying. It's no fun living with granddad. If one of the kiddies gets sick, then Carolyn's got to rely on notes being sent to inform her of the progress of that sickness. It's terrible. Still, a bit of house hunting will provide a distraction. It will be Ormond Lodge near Kew that they acquire. The old Duke of Ormond, Jacobite, had to run away in a hurry, so he's left the house fully furnished. Apparently he had very good taste. Jim and George will find out that the kiddies are looking to buy that place, and he will do whatever he can to stop the sale going through. Too bad. The Prince and Princess have too many supporters, and we'll get past all of Jim and George's roadblocks. Great, now we can renovate. And I can tell you, my dear listener, that this thing has got a bath in it, made from copper, with copper pipes to get the water in and out. Marvellous. Can't get into the gardening, by which I mean probably telling other people what to do. One part of the garden will have a snarlery. You can knock out a snarlery yourself, my dear listener. Doesn't take up much room in your garden or on your balcony. Then you can tell people you've got a ranch, can't you, with livestock. And you can fry those dear little things up in butter and garlic, and there you go, you big old snarl farmer. Although I would think a royal snarlery would be probably a big affair with fine and fancy buildings. Then we can rename Ormond House to Richmond Lodge and our happiness levels are elevated. So German George will elevate his awfulness. Here's an example. The Prince and Princess plan to see a play, The Indian Emperor. German George will say any actor who performs for the Prince and Princess will be sacked. So the Prince and Princess cancel their tickets. Terrible stuff, isn't it? It's just so childish. German George can see he will never win the popularity contest, so will offer terms. Provided the Prince would dismiss such of his servants as were disagreeable to the King and that for the future he would take none but such as should be approved by His Majesty. That he should give up his children and such a sum for their education as His Majesty should appoint. That he should neither see nor keep correspondence with any, but such as His Majesty should approve of. And lastly, he should beg the Dukes of Roxburgh and Newcastle's pardon. Ah, shit, that's going to be a pretty easy no, isn't it? German George wants to just run his son's entire life. Time for George to go to Hanover again, and there'll be no role for the Prince this time. It's going to be a Regency Council. They do, however, get a bit of access to the kiddies. Carolyn will open her salon. It's to attract the top poets and whoever to a court for a chat. Carolyn will always be bright and cheerful and the life of the party. That got a compliment from Sarah Churchill, Duchess of Marlborough, and a compliment from Sarah is pretty bloody rare. In come the poets, but some of these guys want jobs or handouts, and if the jobs and handouts don't come, then the fawning friendship can turn into animosity pretty darn quickly. Henrietta was instrumental in getting some of these guys to Carolyn. She got Jonathan Swift in, who wrote, "Her Majesty shall never be my exalter, and yet she would raise me, I know, by a halter." Yeah. Swift thinks that if he kowtows down to Carolyn. She'll have him by the nuts. So, yeah, he's not too fussed. Alexander Pope will write that she is intellectually pretentious. Oh, dear, see, he didn't get much either. That led Swift to write, a perfect goddess born and bred, appointed sovereign judge to sit on learning, eloquence, and wit. And I think we can take that as sarcasm. But it's not just snotty poets coming in. Here comes Antonio Conti, philosopher, scientist to chat about whatever. Maths, medicine, Newton, and who cares what he's got to say, because here comes Voltaire. Oh, jackpot, lucky Carolyn. Voltaire is definitely on my list of dinner guests just as soon as I get to heaven. Voltaire will dedicate his writings on Henry IV, that's, I should say, Henri IV, the Frenchy guy, to Carolyn. Henri IV, you might recall, that was Henri of Navarre, where we're doing all that Catherine de Medici and Huguenots and killing stuff. Voltaire has poor little Henri IV as needing protection from our big brave Gloriana. And so, according to Voltaire, we need to protect the memory of the magnificent Elizabeth I, and the best way to do that is to find someone whose virtues resembles Elizabeth. Oh, look, and here she is. So I dedicate this writing to her, our dear Royal Highness Princess Carolyn. Marvellous sucking up by Voltaire there. And so Carolyn's gatherings were getting a bit weird. You got your usual staff, the gossip and the jokes, and mix into that science, philosophy, literature and whatever. It's all mixed in. Carolyn, though, was deadly serious about learning. She got in books by brainiacs like Francis Bacon and John Locke, guys like that. She can now read about empiricism from Bacon and reason from Locke. There you go, she's getting best of both worlds. Okay, we've had poetry, science, philosophy, so what about religion? Of course, she's our Protestant defender. Our English have been a tiny bit disturbed by Isaac Newton. That is because Isaac Newton was a tiny bit disturbed by the Holy Trinity, 3 is 1 and 1 is 3. Like your podcaster, Isaac Newton said, how the fuck can 3 be 1 and 1 be 3? And don't just say, trust us, it works out. No, write down a formula, show us your workings. Anyway, Leibniz over there in Germany did not like Newton stuffing around with the Holy Trinity. Newton can call on a guy, Dr. Samuel Clarke, to be a go-between in this dispute. And that's not fair, really, because Dr. Samuel Clarke totally agrees with Isaac Newton. Dr. Clarke has also been writing, demonstration of the being and attributes of God. Yeah, I know, tricky. He also published the Scripture Doctrine of the Trinity, wherein every text in the New Testament relating to that doctrine is distinctly considered. Now, the bottom line for Newton was that only God alone is self-existent. Oh, dear. And worse, only God alone is independent. Oh, dear, dear, dear. And that, my dear listener, is why God can go fishing every Sunday, leaving the baby Jesus and the Holy Spook to do their own thing on Sundays. And the church will say, hey, mate, stop publishing books on the bloody Trinity. Dr. Clarke will visit Carolyn. First thing she will do is read his books. For Carolyn, they're a smash hit. Dr. Clarke is considered to be unorthodox, but that's okay with Carolyn. The disagreement between Leibniz and Newton will not be resolved by Carolyn, but both guys will want her to take their side. In fact, the disagreement will not be resolved by anyone, of course. It's magical, and it isn't the real problem anyway. I think it might be about calculus. Leibniz published Calculus in 1684. Newton didn't publish his until 1693, but said, no, I might not have published till 1693, but I actually found it in 1666, so why win and suck on that Leibniz? And in the English-speaking world, we are all with Sir Isaac Newton. We are. We don't care about Leibniz because he's a German, and we speak English, so we're with Newton. Newton won. Back to the 3 is 1 thingy, and because Carolyn likes Dr. Clarke's stuff, she will support Newton. And Carolyn became acquainted with Newton and became a big fan of his. Supporting the English brainiac over the German brainiac is further evidence of her becoming firmly English. It's tough stuff because we're into things like comparing the bread without yeast to, well, the theory of gravity. Yeah, they are not similar things. It's crazy stuff. Now, Dr. Clarke will refuse to translate Leibniz's book on theodicy into English, even though the English version was to be dedicated to Carolyn. I know that makes her sad. Don't be sad, sweetie. Theodicy is just total fucking nonsense. That doesn't alter Carolyn from being a Dr. Clark fan, though. Carolyn will get letters between Clark and Leibniz into a published edition with a dedication to herself. It's getting worse, though. Carolyn is conducting Newton's experiment on light for herself and writing to Leibniz saying how great this stuff is. Oh, Leibniz is not happy about that. She's favouring Isaac Newton. Leibniz will die and that publication can now happen. A collection of papers which passed between the late learned Dr. Leibniz and Dr. Clark in the years 1715 and 1716 relating to the principles of natural philosophy. Oh, see, marketing is still coming up with catchy bloody titles. Carolyn also spoke to a wide range of churchy types, not just the big dicks. Carolyn liked the more ordinary guys as well. It's all informal theological debate. Bores the shit out of Prince George. He wants nothing to do with that stuff. All good for the still hugely popular Carolyn. We are, however, all wondering why she hasn't stepped in to heal the rift between Dad and his lad. Petitions are coming in saying, there is none so proper as your Royal Highness to assuage these jealousies and reduce both parties to a reunion. On the other hand, some Catholic guy will insult her. Oh shit, that won't go well for him. It will be a trial and the mob are out with calls to whip the guy. And the guy doing the whipping will be the darling of the mob once his work is done. In comes Walpole to have a crack at fixing the dad and lad problem. He's smart and knows who the brains of the outfit is, so he's working with Carolyn. This is where we'll see that Carolyn is pragmatic. The only beneficiaries out of the current situation, Dad and his lad fighting, are the Jacobites. Concessions made to German George ultimately benefit the royal couple. Yeah, they'll win in the end, because German George is going to die. But the problem is Prince George is totally sceptical that a deal would work, any deal. And Carolyn correctly sees that so far as power goes, well, she's got none. A quote from Carolyn to her top lady. I see how all these things must go. I must be the sufferer at last and have no power to help myself. Correct. That's how it was for her mum, Eleanor, and that's how it was for her mother-in-law, Sophia Dorothea, who Carolyn never ever got to meet. As you might expect, with royals, it'll be back and forth with this detail and that detail and that detail and this detail because we're trying to knock out a deal. But Carolyn was rather excited, writing to her friend Charlotte Clayton. I give you, my dear Clayton, the good news that the reconciliation will be made today and that I shall soon have the satisfaction of naming you, my dear Clayton, without constraint, mine. Yeah, Carolyn thinks it's all going to be good and people will be able to visit her again without them being banned by the king. It's been 3 years of that bullshit. Jeez, this Vivaldi stuff's getting a bit out of hand, isn't it? We have the brief meeting between Dad and Lad. Big old nothing burger. No return of the kiddies to the prince and princess, and Caroline is boo-hoo-hooing, and little Anne will get smallpox. Carolyn is allowed to sit with her daughter every day from 11 to 3, then 6 to 11. Carolyn is not allowed to have anything to do with Anne's medical treatment. The prince had had a 5-minute meeting with Dad. Carolyn's turn, and she will get an hour and 10 minutes of George telling her, it's all her fault. Yes, Carolyn, you should have made Prince George a better prince. And from now on, Missy, you need to use all your non-power to make that little turd behave. There's no record of what Carolyn said, but she came out of the room with a smile, saying to everybody that German George had been totally kind to her. Her ladies will note that Carolyn is a very good actress. She will even write to her sister-in-law, Sophia Dorothea, in Germany, saying, what a great result it was, that meeting with German George, and how happy she was. A few days later, and we'll have the premiere of Handel's Radamisto. The king and the prince will attend in separate boxes. The princess will not attend. The theatre will be packed out. We all want to see Dad and his lad kissing and making up and being all happy. Here's the report. The king spoke not to his son nor to any of his friends. Now what had happened here was that Sophia Dorothea had gotten Carolyn's letter, so then she wrote to Dad saying, hey, it was great to hear from Carolyn about how happy she is and that the family thing's all resolved. German George will write back to Sophia Dorothea saying, I don't think Carolyn's being fair dinkum with you. The reality is all she does is make things worse. I guess from German George's point of view, well, yeah, probably is right. Carolyn has done the stand by your man thing. German George also suspected correctly that Walpole had forced an apology out of the prince and that the apology wasn't fair dinkum either. Let's get Carolyn to 37 and she's up the spout. Now that's a bit old for the time, so it's not all champagne and reefers in her court. We previously had the 3-day labour for a dead baby and then George William died very young, then we had a miscarriage, so Carolyn's not encouraged that she will be having a happy pregnancy and birth. Carolyn will be getting the lawyers in. Yep, that's right. She wants the lawyers to advise her on what power she has to say who will be in the room when that baby comes out. Surprise, princess, you actually have some say. Great. And so it'll be invitation from Carolyn only that will get people in. And despite our misgivings, here is a straightforward delivery, baby boy. This baby boy will be called William Augustus because that's what Carolyn wants. The godparents will be Fred William and Sophia Dorothea of Prussia because that's what Carolyn wants. German George isn't fighting at this time, but nor is he returning their daughters to George and Carolyn. As for kiddies, there's actually more up there. 1723, a girl, Mary. 1724, a girl, Louisa. And in 1725, for 42-year-old Carolyn, it will be the 11th and last pregnancy, miscarriage. Miscarriage is unhappy, but Carolyn can pack up the baby-making bits of her insides and close the baby factory down. And she really should have done that earlier, if she could. She had scored an umbilical rupture with the pregnancy of Louisa. Carolyn will be stoic about the whole thing, stiff upper lip, and suffer in silence, and suffer she will. Yes, very painful. Now, this family's a bit weird. Do you not think, my dear listener? Kiddies are living in three different places. Frederick in Hanover is on his Pat Malone. The three older kiddies are with German George, and the three younger kiddies, and it's 10 years younger, these three, are with Mum and Dad. Prince George had tried to get Fred out of Germany and over to England, but German George said no. German George does allow Carolyn by now to visit the three older girls, but then they live in a court where German George is regarded with a bit of contempt and their mother is treated with suspicion. Each little princess has her own staff of German George appointees. But we do like to knock out artworks depicting one big happy family of all these different kiddies, many of who haven't even met each other. This is not a happy family life for Carolyn. Carolyn, though, will continue to be pragmatic. She will visit the older three as often as possible and be very involved with the younger kiddies, William, Mary and Louisa. She will be present for their lessons or, if not, get a report from their teacher. The younger kiddies will have their routine set that is a mirror of the older kiddies' routine. Young George will also be involved in the kiddies' upbringing and, once again, we see public praise for these two. Sarah Churchill will visit one day and catch Carolyn in the middle of handing out a bit of stick to one of the kiddies. It was a thing at the time to punish the kiddies, but generally speaking, that sort of activity is a bit below princess level. But the older princesses living with German George also cop it, but they just get scolded by letter. Here's one to younger Carolyn. Carolyn, I pray you quit your indolence, which prevents you from expressing your pretty thoughts and makes you act as if you had neither feeling nor reason. So it's tough discipline, but on the other hand, the Duchess of Buckingham reports that the house is rather untidy due to a lack of discipline for the kiddies. Can't win, can you? Carolyn will constantly encourage both set of kiddies to think of themselves as one big happy family. Yeah, good luck. Time for controversy. Oh, big controversy. Big controversy. The country will be divided. Carolyn will have 10-year-old Amelia and 8-year-old Carolyn inoculated against smallpox. Carolyn has had it and Prince George caught it from her, if you remember. Then daughter Anne got it, and that was a bad case, which she survived, but she got the bad facial scarring. It had been a 2-month epidemic at the time, with more than a few fatalities. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, having returned from Turkey, explained to Carolyn how the process worked, and Carolyn has had it done, with the anti-vax movement being formed pretty much at the same time. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu had previously had the treatment applied to her kiddies, who both got the mild symptoms for a few days, then got over it. And so inoculation will go on until we wipe smallpox from the face of the earth, somewhere in the 1970s it was. One of the very few examples where every country on the planet managed to work cooperatively. It is possible, yeah, just highly unlikely. Carolyn will send the guy to Hanover to inoculate sickly Fred. Carolyn's younger kiddies will also be inoculated. About 10,000 kiddies will be inoculated, and that's mainly thanks to Carolyn. But lots of people just can't get it in their heads that you make your kiddies sick in order to protect them from the thing that just made them sick. It doesn't seem logical, does it? Churchy types, of course, chip in with God sends disease to punish the sinful, rather than something cheerful like God helps those who help themselves. But how it works, of course, my dear listener, I'm sure you're aware, you get a mild form of the sickness which builds up your own immune system and prevents you from getting it again. And so time passes, my dear listener. Carolyn is doing things like ensuring her daughters have clothes made from similar fabric, Irish plaid, for example. And Carolyn's perhaps eating donuts and hearing the rather chubby Walpole calling her the fat old bitch behind her back. She's 44, chubby, and we're back to German George dying, so she is also finally Queen of England. Well, Queen consort, to be technical, but yeah, let's say she identifies as Queen. Is that good enough? Her Majesty, something like that. And she identifies her man as King consort. Yeah, that's how she sees it. She'd like to see herself as the Queen and George as the consort, but she wouldn't tell him that to his face. But what am I saying anyway? Because look, here's our new glorious King George II leading straight into royal action. His orders are to have not one but two portraits of his mum hung up. I have a suspicion that our new King and Queen shed zero tears for German George. Our princess had been forced to leave her 7-year-old son behind in Germany. Then 3 years later, she got given the boot from her home and told to leave her remaining kiddies behind. But the king is dead, and it seems for Carolyn, best forgotten. Sarah Churchill, Duchess of Marlborough, can report to us across the centuries that Carolyn looked inanely happy at her silly beheading. Sure, Sarah, after 25 years of waiting in unhappy circumstances, then yes, maybe she should look happy. Yeah, they played a bit of that at the silly behatting of glorious King Charles III, but it was actually written by Handel for George II. Yeah, go on a bit with the hallelujahs, don't they? Anyway, what do we care? Just to say it's all about Handel writing the music for the ceremony for me. It is a big show. We splash cash on a new organ for Westminster Abbey, and we'll combine the Westminster Abbey Choir with the Royal Chapel Choir to see if we can get that kind of wall of sound going. But no, so let's off to the opera house and get some Italian voices to boost it up even more. And what are they singing about? Check this out. Upon thy right hand did stand the queen in vesture of gold, and the king shall have pleasure in thy beauty. Hey, look, Carolyn's in a vesture of gold. She is glowing. That's what happens if you got a lot of gold in your frock. And she's got all sorts of fridge magnets over her. Well, more like pearls and precious stones, but lots and lots of sparkly things to reflect the light. The golden tissue veiled the dazzling air of light, too strong for vulgar eyes to bear. Yeah, a common smelly like me might have been blinded if I tried to look at glorious Carolyn. Allow me to bring you down a bit. In Carolyn's case, it was all facade and no substance. She borrowed sparkly things from all the finest ladies in England, then wanted more, so she borrowed from the London jewellers. Then she wanted even more, so she went to the London Jews, and she has blinged herself bigly. Where are the royal sparklers, you might be asking? Why did she have to borrow all this stuff? Well, Melusine and the half-sister slash mistress is the answer. They've got the royal sparklies. Is it worse? Yeah. That vesture of gold, the glowing frock of magnificence, was recycled. It was Mary's frock from back when Mary and William got their silly hats. And there might be a little bit of symbolism in that, wearing Mary's frock. William and Mary were crowned as joint rulers. Perhaps a message for us, but if so, it is trumped by Carolyn being behatted as Queen Consort. She is not equal to the King, no. Now, which lady's got to carry the train is what the gossip magazines want to know. With equal steps attendant on the Queen, three royal virgins in the train were seen. Yeah, that sounds like the poetry from Rupert Bear that I used to read when I was a six-year-old or something. Carolyn, having been reunited with her three eldest daughters, got those girls onto the job. It's a show of family unity. The media were beside themselves in describing our magnificent big show. This was more magnificent than Louis XV's silly behatting, and even better than the Holy Roman Sausage Emperor Charles VI, who Carolyn had previously dumped. £8,720 for this party. Things will really start to pump up in about 100 years when George IV will spend £238,000. And of course, in our day, our darling Chuck splashed out £125 million. Oh well, if I'm going to be fair, I guess British taxpayers splashed out £125 million and I'm certain they feel it was worth every bloody penny. Our couple, though, did well. The budget was an increase of £1,500 on George I, so they just increased it by inflation, really. Yeah, maybe I'm being a bit generous, but they didn't increase it terribly much, is the point. And it was Carolyn borrowing bling that lit it all up. Carolyn's skirt had so much bling on it, they had to devise a pulley for the thing to go up and down for the bits where she had to kneel. Bottom line for our contemporaries was that it was the finest silly behatting in the history of England. Now, I don't think they'd seen them all to be able to make the comparison. And who knows, maybe Wicked King John put on a super show. It's going nicely, is it not? It is. And part of this is that our royal couple have been a couple for 22 years. Unlike a lot of royal couples, they've been really together for almost 22 years. It was just that 6 months that George went off to do his soldiering. They, like many couples who were together for a long time, have become unified in their thought processes. They agree on lots and lots of things. George has been madly in love with Carolyn, and Carolyn is at least very, very fond of George. History can throw up funny little snippets like this one. If the pair were getting their portraits done, Carolyn would take the artist aside, have a little whisper in his ear and say, "Look, make George look no more than about 25 years old." And George would be whispering to the artist, "Make Carolyn look no more than 28. Isn't that sweet? George will get Walpole in to help him with a little job. He wants to formalise the value of his queen consort in the form of jointure. Great stuff. It talks about the sincere and perfect love and affection which His Majesty bears to Her Majesty, and talks about constancy and greatness of mind peculiar to herself. And she's a great mum and a zealous Protestant. Hang on, George, you were saying she was a great king, but then apparently George was genuinely clueless that Carolyn was running the royal show. It's one of the things that makes him considered to be a bit of a simpleton. Plenty of other people got it and wrote about it, although, to be fair, plenty of other people didn't get it. It will eventually lead to a play, The Festival of the Golden Rump, in which Carolyn gives George a brandy enema. What? Yeah, that's what it says. Carolyn gives George a brandy enema, so that he will return to doing what she tells him to do, while Walpole looks on approvingly. The Festival of the Golden Rump itself will lead to the Licensing Act of 1737, which gives the government control over what is being said about the government. That is censorship of criticism of the government, which all governments really, really, really want to do, but it sort of doesn't really fit with the freedom and democracy stuff. So if they do it, they've got to do it slyly. Other sources have it that we were all overestimating Carolyn's power in Team Royal and that she was mainly just doing PR. Can the record shine any light? Sure can. And we can see that Carolyn was doing lots of foreign affairs work, meeting diplomats and actually doing deals and top-level stuff. Stuff we normally do not let go anywhere near girlies. Carolyn was also rather interested in the succession, looking at the arguments proposed by the Whigs, the Tories and the Jacobites, leading to perhaps the criticism that she had masculine interests. Yes, well, criticism because that view of Carolyn includes her belittling George, if she's doing the masculine stuff. Ah, crikey, look at it, 2023, and really the best women in 2023 are the ones with dicks, aren't they? They're women of the year and they're breaking all sorts of women's sporting records. Yeah, these newfangled women. Mind you, yeah, not for me. Having had some happiness with the silly behatting, it's time to bring it all down and think of Walpole, who seems to have gone from hero to zero with the death of German George, who we haven't given a post-mortem, have we? Did we? I don't know if we did. Let's do it nice and fast. German George was ridiculed by the English. They didn't like him because he was too German for them. George made pretty much no effort to be popular. It just wasn't his thing. He avoided the royal box at the theatre and would sneak out incognito to visit his friends. On the other hand, the Europeans saw him as pretty darn good. He was thought of as an Enlightenment king with his relaxed views on religion. He allowed his critics to publish their anti-George stuff and provided sanctuary to Voltaire, and you've got to give him 10 million points for that one. The guy was over 50 when he moved to England. That's a bit late in life to get yourself a new cultural identity. At the end of the day, we've seen a further move of power away from the king and over to Parliament under George. Parliament is where the action is, and why we might want to look back in at our poor old arsehole Walpole. Silly old turd. We left Walpole probably feeling downbeat after telling George that his dad was dead and George telling Walpole to take his instruction from Sir Spencer Compton. That is code for saying, you're out, mate, because Compton is now my best boy. But truly, Walpole was boo-hoo-hooing. Yeah, there was water coming out of his eyes. He got tons of sympathy for Walpole, none for anybody else. Compton, obviously, was not an enemy of Walpole. He was Speaker of the House and Treasurer to the Prince, and you can't get those sort of jobs if you were an enemy of Walpole. No way. Have we got a description of Compton? A plodding, heavy fellow with great application but no talent. His only knowledge, forms and precedence, and his only insinuation, bows and smiles. Now George II will tell him to prepare a royal address to Parliament. Oh, shit, that's beyond me, says Compton to himself. He'll be straight off to Walpole. Hey, Wally, can you draft me up a royal address to Parliament? Of course I can. I'm Walpole, for fuck's sake. Here, watch me not only do that, but while I'm doing it, I'll get a letter from Frenchy Cardinal Fleury saying, G'day, George number two, just a friendly note to say France and England should continue to be besties. Love, your mate, André Hercule de Fleury. Kiss, kiss, kiss. And just to totally dazzle you, Compton, old boy, I'll have my brother Horatio come bolting in to the new king to say, hey, George, you really need to get to make sure you've got a good relationship with the Frenchies, particularly de Fleury. Then I can give him the letter from de Fleury and my draft of his magnificent speech. Yeah, it wasn't quite that way. Walpole's got to have his good boo-hoo-hoo first. Here you go, here's a quote. He took me into his arms with a flood of tears that came immediately from him, crying out that the kindness of his friends had drawn a weakness from him, which his enemies should never do. Yeah, so sad, isn't it? And Walpole went on to say it's all down to Compton, and that's what everybody thought. Compton is currently top of the pops. George II will now offer Compton the treasury gig. God, fuck, beyond me, he says. I can't do that shit. Now, if we could time travel, my dear listener, we could go back and tell Compton, hey, mate, you have millions to do all the bloody work. You just have to sit around and look good and take the salary. George, too, is starting to see he has picked a dud as best boy. And Carolyn can whisper in George's ear, and before you know it, Walpole is invited into a chat about the civil list, I think. Walpole, that's what we want to talk about today, the civil list. That is, how much money is George going to get? Great. Walpole can now say, oh, gee, you don't get much, do you, George? And George, you certainly should get more cash, and George, well, can he get some more cash? Walpole's on the job. So, yeah. It's a win-win. Now, surely somebody must lose. Could it be, let me think, could it be the taxpayer? Could they be the ones losing? Yeah, I guess. Off to Parliament, where Walpole will propose, let's continue to pay the £700,000 a year, plus George too should get the £100,000 he was getting as Prince of Wales. We need to adjust up a little bit. And then he's going to need £100,000 a year for his heir, Frederick. That'll be a tidy $900,000 a year, which was the bid from Walpole. This is how much money I can give you. Now, Pulteney had come in, and he'd bid up more than £900,000, but even thick George knew that Pulteney would struggle to get sixpence out of a Walpole-dominated parliament. Besides, Pulteney had miscalculated trying to get to George through Henrietta Howard and not Carolyn. Bottom line is that George the genius will see it all clearly. Walpole is the man, and so it's just a matter of Walpole arranging things nicely. Things like getting Compton the paymaster general gig, which provides free money, and you just turn up, you sit around for 5 minutes, and you go home for the rest of the year. And Compton can get a barony and be Lord Wilmington. There you go, Compton's happy as a pig in mud. There will be some other job switches that Walpole needs to attend to make sure everybody's happy, then that's it. He is back at the top of the greasy pole. Yeah, a bit of jaunty little autumn by Vivaldi there to celebrate Walpole's return to top of the pops. The death of a monarch signals a general election back at the time, so we should have a general election. Here is a letter on record to Walpole about a seat in Cornwall. I am to acquaint you that Parson Bedford has secured 150 votes at Tregony at £5 a vote. I find he has been tampered with, and some overtures have been made to him by a merchant in London, who purposes to disperse the money, making his wife a present of plate, and preferring his son Thomas to the command of a ship of 40 guns. This proposition is so far agreeable. I see he is fixed in the single resolution, if his son Thomas Bedford cannot by you be made lieutenant of a man of war, you must put an equivalent in his hands in lieu of the lieutenancy. Otherwise, he will not now trust to any man's honour, and he tells me this he wrote to you about. Ooh, yeah, I'm not sure about his grammar there, but it's pretty straightforward corruption. A guy wants his lad to get a sailor's job, well, a lieutenancy, and he's been out to buy some votes. Bear in mind, my dear listener, there's only a few people still that have the right to vote. It's not everybody. Certainly not women. Oh, no. Although women, I should check when they start to get to vote. They might already be voting if they happen to own a lot of land. Point is, in this seat in Cornwall, buying up 150 votes will pretty much guarantee you're going to determine the outcome. You can then chat to both major parties and see what they're going to offer to you. This guy did really well, getting his votes for 5 a each. Other records for this election have votes being purchased for £30. At Grand Pound, that got 41 votes, while we paid 3 times that for 3 magistrates, and a mayor cost us £100. Cheaper than what our modern party spent on stupid advertising, I guess. Candidates also have to be in a giving mood, talking about this or that job that they might hand out. not major jobs for ordinary candidates, but jobs nonetheless. There is, of course, way more corruption than this. Things put into place to ensure that we stay in government, but let's cut to the chase for this election and see what happened. Well, it's an increased majority for the Whigs. 415 seats, up 26. Tories, 128 seats, down 41. And Pulteney, with his brand new Patriot Whigs, has picked up 15 seats in his first outing. If you've done your sums, then it's around 75% Whigs in the House of Commons. The result was always going to be something like that, with Walpole having sorted out a nice system of corruption, but the election was worth a look. The Tories have sorted themselves out and are operating as an opposition. Yeah, they've finally kind of got their act together. Every Tory candidate had run a negative press and pamphlet campaign looking to damage the Whigs. They'd done well in that, so they might be back in reduced numbers, but they've got pretty darn good morale and are ready to make Walpole uncomfortable. Walpole, of course, is feeling rather delighted with the result, so that's where we might leave him for a week, feeling delighted. There you go. So if you ever get asked who was the first big metalhead, you could do worse than say it was Vivaldi. And I think for the Fast and Furious, Vivaldi probably outdid Bach, but Bach just wrote beautiful melodies. Oh, I don't know. It's too hard to pick between them. It's a Beatles and Rolling Stone thing for me. Handel's out of the race, yeah. To get us into some historical fiction, and this week it's going to be a movie. Now, when I was born, TV was still a few years away, and so what was happening was that people were knocking out movies, lots and lots of movies, kind of all over the world, but really lots of Hollywood movies, of course, and we got to see a lot of those. And the fair number of Hollywood movies that were out when I was a young'un were about WW2. The movies were action movies. This is the US army types coming in, winning the war, kind of a bit invincible when they go and hit those Nazis. And look, that's probably fair enough because the US is almost permanently at war, so they must permanently want to G up their troops about how great we are and we can never lose. A bit like Henry V's speech that Shakespeare gave him at Jesus Up. Of course, this is now a long time after I was born, long, long, long time. And over more recent years, I've been getting to watch Russian movies about WW2. They're rather different from the American versions. They're not really your action hero stuff, and the Russians do like to pop in lots of stories of the ordinary people and, of course, just how shit war is for them. So this week I got round to watching a movie called Come and See. It's a Soviet era anti-war film, and we're in Belarus, which was part of the Soviet Union and therefore communist. Now the Nazis had a plan, I'm sure you're familiar with this, of exterminating all Jews. But it wasn't just the Jews, there are other people they wanted to exterminate. Jehovah's Witnesses, there you go, Jehovah's Witnesses, they were gone if they got hold of them. Gypsies, gays, people with disabilities, and communists. So in come the Gestapo to this village in Belarus, and they are going to do lots of killing in very nasty ways. The movie itself has been hailed as one of the big best war movies of all times. It's also been called harrowing. I'll go with harrowing. It's a pretty tough watch. But there you go. If you feel like a bit of anti-war stuff, come and see. And I kind of recommend it, and I don't. But for us, it's just a matter of what we're going to go out with. Come and See might be a harrowing war movie, but there's also a Come and See Baby Jesus song. So we'll have that. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
The Bible says, all give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, and his mercies endure forever. Come on, shout hallelujah. Right now, get ready, church. It is harvest time 2022. Put your hands together.
Please leave your message.
Woo! Hallelujah.